little click.
All right. Good afternoon. Yes, my name is Christopher Bolfing. I'm from the University of Arkansas. And the St. John's River is a 300-mile-long, north-flowing river in central Florida on the east coast. It begins just north of the Lake Okeechobee area, down here in the marshes here, extends up north and deposits into the Atlantic Ocean in Jacksonville. It actually consists of multiple rivers, including the Ocklawaha River and the St. John's River. And it's a very complex hydrological and limnological system. It's comprised of numerous lakes, ponds, streams, springs, backwaters, and floodplains. And this is mainly the result of it being or only having a 1% grade over its entire 300-mile-long course, a drop of only about 8 meters. So this flows very slowly, very meandering, and has a very large floodplain. And the hydrology of it is also very complex, because 59% of the river is tidally affected. And tidally affected riverine systems are much less understood hydrologically and ecologically than non-tidally affected areas. There's also a veritable plethora of wildlife that makes the St. John's River its home, including both vegetation wildlife and animal wildlife. And unfortunately, there's also been a number of invasive species that have come in and made it home. And these are unlikely to ever be eradicated, and so they're here to stay. While doing my research, I also noticed that people engage the waterway very differently, and different groups engage it very differently. So you have local native Floridians who recreate and subsist off these waterways, and then again, you've got invasives. So it's a very, very different way. And some of these invasives are here to stay. So when I'm talking about human impact, I'm talking about consumption, extraction, pollution, and destruction of our waterways. When consumption, I'm talking about water that remains within the waterscape. And I get this idea of a waterscape from a potterized scape, of course. And in terms of consumption, the St. John's River Water Management District tracks the consumption of different groups, including the residential and commercial consumption. So residential consumption is around 605 million gallons per day. This is consumed by approximately 4.75 million people that reside in the area. And if we boil this down statistically, of course, this is always going to be a problematic figure. But if we use it as a base standard, we can say that approximately 127 gallons per day per person is what is used. This is a little over what we would expect, because the average person only uses about 30 gallons within the home for cooking and cleaning. So the extra approximately 100 gallons per day is being used outside of the home. In terms of commercial consumption, it's about 74 million gallons per day higher, so slightly more, and I think that it will become clear that this gap is going to continue to increase over time. When we're talking about commercial consumption, we're talking about industrial use by such things as paper mills and oil industry for fracking, and we're also talking about water used by businesses. One of the big no-nos in Florida are all the golf courses. In fact, the Players Club was this week, and that is in Jackson, just outside of Jacksonville, and it's right here on this area. But however, determining the total consumption by commercial is problematic, because a lot of commercial businesses will end up being linked into residential water supplies. So sometimes bathrooms and water fountains at places like malls might be considered residential water supply. So it might already be further out of balance than we already suspect it's going to become. Extraction is kind of a special case of consumption. And here we're talking about where water is totally removed from the waterscape. And the Niagara Bottling Company is the premier case study for this example, for this river area. Its 120-employee facility in Lake County, which is just south of the midway point of the St. John's River watershed, was just recently, in December of 2013, granted an increase of 426,000 gallons per day. This increase is equivalent to approximately, if we use the 127 gallons per day model, is equivalent to over 3,300 residents. This approximates the average yearly increase for the entire county of Lake County. So we see that the allowance increase for a single business is equivalent to the entire increase in residential impact from population increase. And at this point in time, I'd also like to point out the fact that Florida is one of the fastest, if not the fastest, growing population state in the union. It just recently exceeded New York as the third most populous state in the country. Pollution, of course, is the contamination of the waterscape by indirect or direct human activity. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to quantify. This includes, but is not limited to, sewer and septic system contamination, runoff from roadways and from farms, ranches, golf courses, etc. It also includes both residential and commercial dumping, both legal and illegal. And when we go across pollution, we're also engaging extra legal issues, or what Nordstrom referred to as illegality. And in this case, what I'm talking about is a specific paper mill. I'll leave the name out for now. And they decided to move a dump site from a small tributary system into the St. John's waterway into a larger tributary within the same system. This effectively reduced the number of parts per million that it was dumping into the system. Therefore, it did not be able to incur fines for its dumping and was able to increase the amount of dumping that it was able to do just by moving its facility. Destruction of the waterscape is the last topic I'm talking about. And the simple mantra, development equals destruction, covers the bulk of what we're talking about here. Human habitation just simply destroys the environment. It's unfortunate, but true. However, it gets a little bit more complicated in an area like the St. John's River Water Management District, which is comprised heavily of longleaf pine, which requires fire to advance into its adult phase. So we get what we have here from my group informant who told me this. And so the active prevention of forest fire has actually led to almost as much harm in the wetland habitat as the destruction that relates to development. So what we get from these different types of human impact is called eutrophication. This is a process in which the nutrient load becomes out of balance. And in particular here, we're talking about the nitrogen and phosphorus loads that promote bacterial and algal growth. Here, you get a sense of what this toxic algae looks like up close. And clearly, you can see why you would not want to recreate in this or eat fishes that come out of this or have your children be anywhere near this. In fact, some of these algae and bacteria are related to the bacteria, or at least to the bacteria in some of these, are related to flesh-eating strains. And that's why you end up with signs like this, which is on the St. John's River. And it's effectively eliminating access for subsistence and recreation purposes due to health reasons as a result of eutrophication. So I'm going to now focus down on a case study of a specific example of how humans are impacting the environment and how people are understanding how to respond to this in various ways. What people may not know about cattle ranching in America is that it has its home and has always had its home in Florida. When people think of cattle in America, they think of the Wild West and trail rides and cowboys, but it has and always will be likely to remain in Florida with the largest herds. And what we're talking about here is the Avena Ranch, which is proposing to become the third largest head of cattle in the country. It was purchased by Frank Stronach, an Austrian billionaire, in 2010. And what he seeks to do is to replace natural habitat with grass so that he can feed his cows. He also wants to install a slaughterhouse so that he can slaughter them on site and be able to have basically a one-stop facility for processing meat for the public. However, this is what the... Oh, this is really, really dark. You can't quite see this. But this is longleaf pine, and here's your hardwood scrub habitat. So this is what it naturally looks like. So if you think about what he's having to do to get this grass here, he's having to destroy the wetland habitat to replace it with grass. He's having to overconsume water to water the grass as well as to water the cattle. And, which added to this problem, water is notoriously thirsty. So while you're adding all this water to the ground, you think you might actually get it into the groundwater. Unfortunately, most of it does not. The roots take it immediately up in, and then it evaporates from the grass and goes back into the sky. And so you lose that. And then also you get a massive amount of pollution from runoff. And so you have runoff from the cattle ranching operation and the slaughter. And this Silver Springs, 550 million gallons per day whenever it's at its max, unfortunately, because of extenuating drought circumstances in Florida, it's pumping out less than 20% on average. And this is what people are very worried about. This is where the pollution is going to go. His entire facility is only about 5 miles away from this spring system, and it's located on a tributary system that will leach back into the springs. His water consumption request, whenever he purchased the the ranch, he was granted, or it came with about a 500,000 gallon per day allotment, with a total limit, daily limit of 100,000 gallons. His first request is a staggering 13.6 million gallons per day. This was actually less than half of what he had originally talked to reporters about asking for. And whenever he asked for it, there was a massive uproar, both by the public and by the St. John's River Water Management District itself, the regulating agency. They told Mr. Stronach that he had to find a lot of documentary evidence to support his claim. After a year, he was unable to supply such information, and at which time he lowered his request to 5.6 million gallons per day and was granted another year extension to secure the paperwork. That extension went up in March, and in April, he lowered his request yet again to 2.4 million gallons per day and reduced the tract of land that he's requesting to apply this allotment to, which is only about 16% of the total area of land that he has purchased. And so we see that through a lot of groundswelling of environmental activism, there was actually active legislation legislating to prevent him from impacting the environment as much as he wanted to. And so we see a very wide variety of activism that emerges. So some of the most simple and easiest to go about might be these no dumping drains to river signage, which are very commonly found throughout our city. And for a few $1,000s, you could put this on basically every drain in your city, and you feel like you did something. However, not all of them are quite so simple. Based on nostalgia, and so it's referring back to a time when even 30 years ago, people were able to drink the water out of the backyard. They were able to have a plethora of fish and animal species to subsist upon, and no longer do they have these, and so there's part of them reducing this. Of course, you have your pretty standard protesting activism, which is seeking to influence legislation, and then you have very anthropocentric activism. So you have up here, it says, when the river suffers, my business suffers. My livelihood depends on the healthy St. John. So he is equating the health of the river to his economic success. Very anthropocentric. Here we see a direct sign for Frank Stronach. It says, Frank, grow crops for people, not grass for cows. And here we think this might be a slightly more substantive environmental message, but in fact, this is just as anthropocentric. And what these people don't realize is that the devastation to the environment for cutting down wetland habitat to grow farms and the pollution from the runoff from the fertilizers, which are nitrogen and phosphates, which are exactly what caused eutrophication, then you end up with some of the same problems and also massive amounts of consumption for edible plants that aren't supposed to be growing in these high optimum environments in Florida. And so you have another anthropocentric concern. And so looking at all this variety and how people responded to human impact, I started to notice that they fell into two distinct categories. Transnational or international efforts, really, such as the National Wildlife Federation, World Wildlife Federation, or the Save the Manatees Fund. These focus on what I like to call poster species as a way to garner money for their nonprofit organizations. What these do, here's another one. These are very cute animals and people love them. People love to look at them. But what people don't understand is that when they're getting interested in these environments because of poster species only, they have a terrible lack of understanding of the true complexity of the ecological system as a whole. And so what you see with local movements are focusing on other species besides the poster species. Of course, just like everyone else, they love the manatees and the river otters. But they're also very interested in things like bullfrogs and apple snails, which can be used as environmental indicators, kind of an ecological barometer to get a health reading of the system as a whole. And here, we've got organizations that help on this front too, and especially the St. John's River Riverkeeper Society has been extraordinarily helpful in disseminating information to the public about human impact on the St. John's River. But what we've seen in the emergence of social media in the 21st century has been a bridging of these two discrepant categories. And so now we're effectively creating translocal ecological movements by the use of social media like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, which allows people to document the damage to the environment in ways that, and to disseminate that documentation in ways that have previously been completely
completely impossible. And so what we've seen is that social media in the 21st century has brought local interests to transnational audiences. It has also connected local environmental movements transnationally. This is important because it's allowed different groups of people to express what has been successful and unsuccessful in negotiating the complex path for protecting their environment through legislation, politics, socioeconomics, and everything else that is involved in this. And finally, it's also expanded the definition of what it means to be in the field in a similar way that the telephone did in the 20th century. And so now, when you leave the geographic area, you still have access to documentation of what's going on there. You still have access to your informants to be able to get information up to date, goings on as to what's happening. And so it's really revolutionized everything. And to conclude, I'd like to read just briefly from my discussions and my conclusion. First, it seems that obvious that residents, that is, voters, are less likely to be able to influence regulatory commissions than large, wealthy corporations who can hire teams of lawyers to interpret laws favorably for their employers, as well as to directly lobby political bodies in ways that individuals are unable to replicate. This tips the power balance away from voters and towards corporations, which are likely to cause more damage to the environment through their actions, such as the amounts of impact from consumption, extraction, pollution, and destruction of the waterscape. However, grassroots efforts have recently begun putting legislation into the system, in a large part because of the use of social media. Of course, due to limited funding and a general lack of organization, these grassroots campaigns have a very long way to go to compete against commercial lobbying, especially by large-scale transnational corporations, which comparatively have practically unlimited funds and extremely high amounts of internal organization. It seems that the primary focus for protection of the water state should then be focused on addressing this power instability. Second, the population of Florida is increasing rapidly, which places a huge burden not only on the environment, but also on the economy of Florida as a whole. More jobs are obviously necessary to accommodate these increasing populations, and an unfortunate response to this need has been deregulation. Deregulation increases the influx of businesses seeking to make profit from the increasing population, thus bringing in commercial money to local governments, providing jobs for residents, and attracting corporate interests that in turn seek to take advantage of a deregulated environment to consume, extract, pollute, and destroy the waterscape more than they would be able to in a strictly regulated commercial atmosphere. Deregulation, as a result, creates a circular problem. Deregulation increases economic profitability, attracting the influx of both residents and businesses, which further increases population, the need for jobs, and the various impacts that people place upon the environment. Increased populations and increased economic profitability also lead to the corporate creation of lobbies to influence legislation, leading to further deregulation. Thus, again, it is the power instability between what large-scale commercial operations see as a profitable market and the people for whom that market is home.